Strength through discipline, strength through community, strength through action, and strength through pride. Welcome back to Bookwave, the book club podcast. Today we're looking at The Wave by Todd Strasser. This is a book about an experiment that happened in Palo Alto, California in 1967 that resembled much of what happened in Nazi Germany. So, I'm Scott, joined today by Pat.
Hey,
Jason.
Bow, bow, bow.
And William.
Eight.
So, what parts really stick out to you in this book? Or get offer to give a little bit more of an explanation and jump into the story?
Well... I always like reading a book like this, you know, with my German background. It's good to get more insight because I have no idea what happened 75 years ago because I was not alive. This was a quick, easy read. I think I did it in one sitting. And right away, Robert Billings jumped out to me, one of the characters that is introduced right in the history class. I think the biggest thing for me was that in spite of the moral individuality of certain members of the classroom, how quickly the group dynamic just completely took over and shut down everybody. It was just conformity immediately happened. And it was crazy. I actually, in grade 10, had an experiment done like this on us, but it didn't go nearly as far. Our teacher just told us to stand up and like four of us didn't, and everybody just kind of pressured everyone into standing up. Like the teacher didn't have to do anything. All the students did the work. Conformity is so easy to slip into. It's kind of disturbing.
Yeah, now that you bring that up, there was like a really similar kind of experiment that we did where they kind of tried to separate the student population into people with blue eyes and people without blue eyes. So it was like, I don't know, it was pretty weird, but like at the same time you were given a badge based on your eye color, and you weren't allowed to use certain stairwells. If like I have brown eyes, I wasn't allowed to use the stairwell at the far end of the school. It was just for like a little day, and everyone was completely self-aware of it. Like everyone was like learning the same kind of lesson. It wasn't like this book where they just, all right, it's time for a little experiment. Let's do some stuff.
That's great. The education system in Canada is perverted, man.
Very weird and perverted. But
not that very weird. Hey, it's my country.
Okay, fine. You can be perverted as much as you want. But to go on to what you said, Will, it all started off when Ben was just getting sick and tired of his students not taking his class seriously. And then he's had this idea based on the reactions that the students had after watching the archival footage of the Nazis in the classroom. And I think that's what really, really picked it up, because you see him just kind of fixing the film reel and everything, and he's kind of flimsy about it, and as Mr. Ross was going through the film reel and everything, he has this moment of, okay, how can I as a teacher in a way keep the classroom more interesting and engaging? And you kind of see how the students are kind of, you know, snickering every once in a while when he asks them a question about, you know, motivation, you know, what motivates you, and they're like, ugh, That's too much work. Why do I care? And then he essentially starts off with, you know, posture and everything. And that's the first line of command that he gives to his students about proper posture, and that leads to more engagement and everything like that. And so that's where I discovered it, how it started off.
It's, yeah, and it's interesting. Go ahead, Jason.
It's possible that the teacher wasn't disciplined himself, and that is why his class wasn't disciplined, because he wasn't invested in what he was teaching. He wasn't, he didn't have the discipline. So he starts with the discipline equals power, and discipline starts with posture, which is one of the first rules that we hear from Jordan Peterson in his book. You know, stand up straight with your shoulders back.
Yeah, that's rule number one.
And then when everybody starts doing that, you start to feel like you're part of something greater than yourself. And as a human, you know, that feels good to be part of something. If you're standing out in the street and you start pointing your hand up to the clouds, somebody else is going to stop most likely and look up and see what you're pointing at. They might even start doing it themselves. And you can kind of have this social experiment where everybody starts doing something that maybe it's, in this case, it's pretty logical. You want discipline. So he starts creating a group. And it's kind of in response to what they were watching in the history class. They're studying Nazi Germany. And the students didn't believe that, you know, that a person could actually do some of the things that they're reading about. They say, you know, there's no way that ordinary German citizens would allow that to happen. They say, you know, the Jewish people wouldn't allow that to happen. And I've heard this argument on the slavery side. There's no way that slaves would just allow themselves to be enslaved. Why didn't they pick up guns and start an armed revolt? Or why didn't the ordinary German citizens start a revolt against the Nazis? And it kind of brings up another question, is when is a good time to start a revolt?
That is not a question I'm going to answer in this sentence. But the thing that I was thinking about the posture and, you know, the unconscious mind is the hypnotic element to it. Because when you go into like a power pose, right, your brain says, okay, well, this posture means I'm confident. And so when you stand up straight with your shoulders back, you literally get permission from your brain to be confident. And then to be in a room with a bunch of people doing the same thing as you, oh my goodness, you're a part of a pack. The tribalistic part of you says, I am like them and they are like me, and together we are stronger and I want to continue to be like them. And it's like,
yeah.
I think the big thing too is, at least with Nazi Germany, you know, and same within the class even, like they were degrading the authority of their teacher. They were showing up late. They were bickering amongst each other. They're making fun of each other. They're infighting. But the minute you make a group of people identify with the fact that they are related, similar, and a group, and you give them a common enemy outside, all of that infighting, it fades away, and you can start to direct your energy much more intentionally. And that feels good. But if you don't know what you're doing, it gets pretty dangerous.
And that's 10 times more valuable for a character like Robert Billings. Like, we don't ever get his point of view in this book. Like, the main character is actually a young girl named Lori, who is very conscientious and understands what's happening and is really the only one in the class that doesn't fall for the whole wave movement. But whenever you get a glimpse of Robert Billings in this situation, it's like, yeah, he's the kid that just sits in the back of the class, always slouching and never really participating, and all of a sudden you put him in a power pose. That's going to be like the first time in that setting that he felt any kind of confidence. And then they put him in a situation where they make him a leader because they want to drill the classmates so they can, you know, get up, make a mess, and then get to their seats as soon as possible. And they keep doing these drills. Then they realize, well, it would be a lot easier if we just lined up first and then walked to our desks like that. And then they realize, well, that puts Robert at the front of the class. And a lot of things happen in here when you see yourself as the first person in a line of, you know, 15 to 30 children. It doesn't matter. Like, you become a leader in that little symbolic way. That's gonna change your DNA. That's going to do something more to you than any other lesson plan can.
And it makes action a lot easier. When you give such a loose structure to the group, it makes it so that an individual who has surrendered their individuality and just says, okay, well, I know this about the group, and I know what I need to do, and it's very easy to perform. It's simple to discover what to do next. And that's what we see by the end of the experiment, is the group is actually creating orders unto itself that are just simple little tasks. Like, oh, let's turn the pep rally into a fascist protest. Or let's get some banners and let's do this and let's make an exclusive area for seats. Because it's, you give just enough structure that you can see that there's holes missing, and you can have a whole group of individuals working towards this common cause and easily doing things that make it bigger without knowing where it's going. And I think other than Lori, the other individual that didn't fully conform was, he was a junior and he wanted to get the quarterback position, and he had like this inflated sense of ego and pride and individuality, and he didn't give a damn about the wave, and he wanted to improve his own station, and his self-defined identity was what protected him from that, but it also was what ran him into getting into literal fights with these people.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's like the group of the wave itself is what creates the conflict, and it's what creates the unity. Like, it's great for everybody inside who feels this moment of oneness with all of these people, but anyone who says, like, hey, aren't you acting like a pack of fascists over here? Isn't this turning into a cult? Like, that person, the one who's conscientious enough to say, like, I know where this is going, they're the ones that are going to suffer from all of this. They're going to become the outcast. They're going to be exiled from everybody.
And that was kind of the German population after the First World War. They were the outcasts. They were the downtrodden. They had their infrastructure completely crippled by the Treaty of Versailles, and they didn't know what to do with themselves. And it makes me think of that phrase, if you don't stand for anything, you'll fall for everything. And I think that if you have enough lack of individuality and meaning, I mean, Nietzsche was saying that God was dead at this time. Like, there were a lot of factors that make an entire population not have its own goals and individuality, which I think is the biggest defense against wide sweeping movements. And so, you know, the natural inclination is to get together and rally and be patriotic and be proud of your country and improve the station of your country. And then you get these influences and these factors that you're not even aware of, because you're not really doing the thing for yourself. You're doing the thing because it's easy and obvious.
Yeah, that reminds me of a quote from Ben Ross, the teacher's wife, when she was talking to Ben about Robert, when she said something along the lines of, well, if he couldn't survive in school before the wave existed, how is he going to make it out in the real world where the wave doesn't exist at all? So, like, how are you really helping this kid? Which then, like, when I read that part, it made me think of, automatically, of Jordan Peterson. It's like, well, yeah, there's some parallels between these two figures. You know, he's gotten him to stand up straight with his shoulders back, he's given him some confidence, but at the same time, that all depends on the fact that he's a part of this group. And one of my biggest questions is, does Robert fall apart after the wave falls apart? Because that question isn't answered by the end of this book. It's kind of very open-ended.
Well, I mean, he broke down in tears, right? Like, he and ended up getting out, taken out for dinner or whatever to have things discussed. But yeah, the long term, I don't know.
Yeah, like, I just like to think about that one character in particular. Like, 1 year later, where was he? Like, in his senior year or whatever. Like, how did the wave affect that guy? Did it have an overall benefit on him, or did it leave him completely demoralized?
I think it would have led him maybe to be more likely to, like, join a fraternity in college. And I wanted to ask what you guys thought the difference of, like, a fraternity and the wave in this high school is.
Well, I'd never been to a fraternity. I never joined one. And I've also never joined movements like this one.
Me neither.
So no.
No. Didn't think we had to say that, but I'll say it now. I got close to a frat in university briefly. I got confused for having started a frat in university. I just got a bunch of people to wear the same shirt and go to dinner together. Everybody thought we were a frat. And literally, so that's actually a funny story. I got everybody on my floor to wear those like tuxedo t-shirts, and we got our nicknames printed on the back at a store downtown. And when we went to the caf to eat, we got the biggest long table. We sat across from each other. Anytime any individual went to get seconds, we all stood up and waited. And yeah, it was a pretty powerful experiment, but that was just me messing around. The fraternity lifestyle was just a party thing, and the identity of brotherhood and messing around. But they were successful. They were more successful than individuals.
William, our very own cult leader.
Well, I think that success is in part through to the idea of strength through community. And I mean, this happened in California, and in the U.S. we have this relationship of for the individual. They're, you know, the rugged individual. We have authors like John Stuart Mill's talking about in his book on freedom, the importance of individuality, but at the same time, being part of a community. Like in a fraternity, individuals can keep their persona and still be part of the group. Whereas in this wave, it almost seemed like there was no individual anymore. It was your identity was part of the group completely. And, you know, there was a line in this, in the book, the only time the room was that quiet was when no one was there. So you have all these students sitting in a room, they're disciplined. They're all wearing the same clothes to make them part of the community. But it's almost as if no individuals are in that room.
Yeah, I guess it just depends on the limitations you're willing to give and receive whenever you join these certain movements.
Yeah, healthy boundaries for sure. But
I think Ayn Rand would have something to say about this kind of thing. Like, she's all on the individual side. Like, she's not about community at all. Like, if you're not looking out for yourself, you're not living objectively. Like, you're not living in coordination with reality. You're just not. So you have to be an individual. But I'd say there's definitely a line somewhere. You got to split the difference.
I think Rand would also say that the group would necessitate a demoralization of the individual. That when you get your value from the community, it means that you're worth less.
Yeah, maybe not worthless, but worth less.
And I think the lens through when the book opens, the teacher's asking the students, you know, how did this happen? And the students are asking, well, why didn't any of the individuals in Germany stand up? So they're viewing it through the lens that the German citizens somehow maintained their individuality, but what was really happening was a group dynamic, you know, similar to what the wave was creating. You had the fascist creating, you know, a group, and then years later, it is a very slow movement, but years later, that's when they started throwing Jewish people and gypsies and homosexuals into the concentration camps. It didn't happen overnight, so it was a very slow and gradual thing, similar to what we saw here with the last part of the slogan being strength through action. Mm-hmm. So in Nazi Germany, they didn't just start with action. They started with discipline. They started with community. And then they got to action.
And the cool part about that is in the experiment that actually happened in reality in the 60s, there was a fourth part added, strength through pride. So after they've gotten all the students to, you know, take action, they also instilled them with the element of pride to say, like, yes, your actions are the right thing. Be proud of what you do. Keep going. So that made, like, the ending, the crashing of the whole experiment, that much more impactful. It's like they were all living through the wave, or in the real experiment was called the third wave. And like,
and it's like
that was their everything.
So in today's society, like, we have individuals struggling so much with their own identity and meaning right now that they don't get out of bed, they don't do social interaction, and there's no threat of Gestapo. So imagine the amount of trauma and fear we can instill in ourselves without the existential dread of the military state. Just for a second, imagine how much easier it would be to not make an action when you think that there's Gestapo around the corner.
Yeah, it's like, what do you want to do with your life?
It's like, it's so easy to choose fear.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And it's really excruciating when some members of these cults and movements don't even realize at the very end what they are actually accomplishing. Like, it's very hard to hold up a mirror in front of them and say, do you realize what you're doing here? Like, can you compare this to other movements that have succeeded or even failed? It's really hard to put it that way sometimes.
Yeah. And to just to go back to the setting of like what these people were going through, it wasn't like teachers or something that were getting them in trouble with the wave. It was their fellow students. In the actual experiment, there were 20 reports, or reports from 20 different students, like telling on their fellow students for breaking the wave rules. Like, they were little snitches. Like, there was only one person to report to, Mr. Ben Ross, or Ron Jones. What was his name? I forget. Yeah, it was Ron Jones. And he was the only authority, and he had 20 students going to him by the third day to say, you know, Lori broke the rules, David broke the rules, James over there, he was getting into a group of four people. We know that's against the rules, right?
Yeah, and it's like, even just the mechanism of how important you yourself get to feel by giving important information to the authority figure and doing good for your leader. And, you know, the more good you do for your leader, the better your leader becomes and the better you feel about doing good for your leader. And it's this vicious feedback loop of dopamine from the wrong thing.
Yeah, it literally turns them into ants. Like, the only individual is the queen, and the rest of them just live vicariously through the queen. They're just like, well, the colony's doing good, the queen's doing good, we're doing good, continue.
But then even he himself loses in his individuality, right?
Yeah,
like the pack becomes autonomous.
That's the whole element of power corrupting. Absolutely. Like, how could you not be corrupted by this huge source that worships you, this army of 10th graders and 11th graders saying, this guy is our Führer, basically. I mean,
it's like almost kids, like, you'd have to never have experienced corruption and think that it wouldn't touch you, right? Like, you'd have no perspective, you have nothing to prepare you for it, and you are in complete disbelief that it could happen to you. And it's like, that's a typical human thought, and we need to take that into consideration.
Yeah, and it corrupts Robert too. Like, he goes from zero to hero, and everybody respects him because he's the teacher's bodyguard, right? So, like, he becomes the very center of this entire movement, and Ben just kind of lets it happen until he puts a stop to it at the end.
I saw some similarities in what happens in real life with that, where people are joining cults. It almost seems like the more damaged a person is, or the more trauma somebody has lived through, the higher the likelihood is that they're going to be open to joining a cult because they feel bad about themselves. And so joining the community or a cult, you know, helps to dissolve some of that self-hatred, and you know, you're now part of a group. You don't have to remember who you were in the past. I also saw a bunch of similarities to what we see in our current political climate. The nationalists in America, there's nationalists in every country. You know, we have these groups of people who they see themselves as part of like a community. Let's just call it a MAGA community, because that's what we have, you know, most.
Oh, jeez.
You just tread that way, do you?
You guys didn't see any similarities in this book?
Well, there's for
sure what we've seen right now.
There's for sure similarities on, you know, the left, the right, the center, the far reaches of each of that spectrum, where it turns into a cult-like experience. Not to say that it is an organized cult, but you could feel the experience of being in a cult while at the same time not, you know, signing a piece of paper to say, yep, I elect the leader. Like, when we were talking about school spirit and all of that with Paul Vanderclay the other day, and he brought up the Ku Klux Klan, like, yeah, I just go for the barbecue. We don't actually lynch anybody. We're not really that culty. Like, you're still in a cult.
I'm in it for the free food, so.
Like, if you feel like you are, that your only political motivation comes from the group that you're a part of, or this one specific source that you get your news from, that's probably a little cultier than it could be. You might be able to do a little bit more effort in finding all the sides. Don't just stick yourself in a bubble in an echo chamber and then decide, yeah, this is right. I don't need to question this. Because if you stop questioning everything that your group tells you, then you're in a cult, whether the cult is identified as a cult or not. Like, your mindset is of in a cult.
Yeah, and I think we see the problems every time that we see a mob or a riot or a protest that gets out of hand. When we have too many people grouped up in a small area who all think that they're doing the same thing but have their own history and their own perception of what it means to actualize their goals. Like that one woman that was screaming it's a revolution in the Capitol building. Like, it's not. You're wrong. It's theft and it's stupid and go home. Like, oh my God. But man, like I think the problem is you start with problems, right? And instead of saying solutions and simplicities and practical stuff, like when you start by saying, oh, discipline equals strength and community and action equals strength, but you don't define what type of community, what type of discipline, what type of action, and in fact what not types of community and what not types of discipline and what not types of action. It's like, yeah, you haven't created something.
That's also kind of how the Nazi regime kind of worked, like, efficiently. Like, that was part of its purpose, like, keep it a little vague, you know, the will to power. How could that not be a bad thing? We're talking about Friedrich Nietzsche here. This is the will to power. Everybody likes power. And, you know, they leaned into that so much that, you know, will to power is a dirty word nowadays. Like, it doesn't have to be. You just have to keep, like, just digging into the specifics. Like, yeah, there's strength in community, but the Nazi rhetoric was depending on the fact that the population would take that too far and too seriously and not ask too many questions, because you have to give your answers in three words or less. You know, you take away their ability to think, you have some good little soldiers on your hands.
They go after the children too. And
always.
And it also goes back to how much limitations you have, because everybody's different. They're not the same.
Mm-hmm. Well, and I think the big thing too, right, is it's the kids that don't want to get called on that are all right with any movement. They're like, well, don't ask me what I think about it, because I don't want to think about it. I don't want to read 50 books a year that talk about the pitfalls of philosophy and human travesty and war and famine and destruction. I don't want to know. Just tell me what I need to do so that I can feel good about myself and think less.
Yeah.
Which is the opposite of what we're doing.
It makes me sad, honestly. Like, I just wish more people would think for themselves.
And I think that every individual would probably punch you in the face and say, I do think for myself. You just don't understand where I'm coming from. But the thing is, they don't understand where they're coming from. And we probably don't either. But we at least know that we probably don't know.
And I also know that other people can tell me something about myself that I haven't realized. So, like, I would genuinely listen to that person who said, you don't know where I'm coming from. I see where you're coming from. Like, okay, tell me then. Where am I wrong? Just...
Yeah, like I'm willing to type up a 5,000 word essay 14 times and have a reciprocal back and forth debate about my values and your values, so long as we don't get lost in emotion and take it personally, right? Like the whole, like, I don't have to respect your opinion, but I ought to respect you. Like, I ought to believe that you're coming from a good intention, and that as a fellow member of this race, you want us all to be happy. And barring psycho and sociopaths and schizophrenics, like, that should hold up. But I see a lot of people just ready to assume the other side are completely deranged and need to figure it out on their own, and they don't want to have the conversation. And it's like, okay, so you're not playing the game. You're not even trying.
Yeah. I've gotten to the point now where I have, like, next to no interest on what somebody's religion or belief is. I just want to know why and how you got there, and then just learn from that experience. Like, when I was, like, going through high school and stuff and reading all these atheists and reading only science fiction and not even acknowledging, like, religious learning or teaching or whatever, and I just wouldn't give it the time of day. It's just like, nah, I don't care. It's all baloney. I feel like I've completely flipped on that. Like, yeah, okay, every belief is valid, but not every reason for that belief is valid. I'm much more happy hearing someone say, I'm a Christian because I have faith and you can't shake that, than to hear someone say, I believe in God just because, you know, my parents said that there was a God, and I just never really thought about it after that. Like, the opinion isn't what bothers me. It's the fact that you're not willing to question that at all. Like, I think every day, like, is there a God? Well, can't think of a reason why there would be, so maybe I'll ask again tomorrow.
And the other problem is that when people join for long periods of time, they don't know what to respond to when somebody questions about the movement that they are in or the cult that they've joined or anything like that. They simply go along with the guidebook that they've given. And if there's a question from an outsider who gives them a question that they cannot answer, they act defensively. They're confused or throw out accusations, which is a big problem.
I was reading an essay yesterday on the concept of choosing to believe, because that's something that interests me, right? Because, like, I cannot definitively tell you what happens after death. I just do not have that evidence, and I will not know until I know. And so, barring that, can I choose to believe in God? And the argument was that, well, no, you can't choose to believe anything, but you can choose to expose yourself to evidence or lack thereof that may guide your beliefs. And if you accept Darwinism, We have evolved to believe the things that are most likely to make us survive. And so you can look at beliefs that, even though the belief isn't, you know, proper, it still makes you survive. The one argument they made was like, our hominid ancestors may have believed they wanted to cuddle with a tiger, and they may have also believed the best way to accomplish that was to run back and hide in their cave every time they saw a tiger. Now, that didn't get them to cuddle a tiger, but it did get them to survive their interactions with the tiger, because their belief was that they needed to run and hide, and they never ended up cuddling. And so then you ask the question, is belief in God necessary for survival? Is religion and faith and spirituality a natural inclination and survival technique? And what do you do about that? But I think what we see in the wave is that we don't have people choosing to disbelieve. They made it easy enough to just accept, and then they didn't do any more metacognition on the matter. And I think that a lot of people don't choose to disbelieve more than they do choose to believe.
I like that.
Thank you.
It also kind of makes me think of Lori too, where she was like the most popular girl in school. If anyone in that class was surviving, it was her. So she was able to actually question it from the outside and say, I got my survival taken care of. Where a character like Robert was like, I haven't really been surviving until now. Now that I have this community, this is what's going to take me forward. I haven't felt like I'm thriving until now. Surviving, probably. Thriving,
yeah.
Different thing.
But then, yeah, and you got to ask the question, like, did Lori question the system because it didn't benefit her, or because there were actual flaws in the system? Because it was uncomfortable for her to have lost her comfort zone. She was top of the class, and then she wasn't. And that immediately causes stress in the human psyche, no matter what your comfort zone is.
Which could come off as a detriment to her own survival. Like, when you're that young, as a high school student, you don't really know the difference between life and death situations and just regular everyday life. You kind of have to learn those things along the way.
Which means, like, she was probably poking holes in the philosophy, not because of the basis or foundation of the philosophy, but just because it was different than what she was used to, and it threatened her way of life.
And also the fact that she had to make some sacrifices, like, and correct me if I'm wrong, but she decided to not join the boyfriend during the football game, or something similar to going through a breakup. Like, like, she had to make that call for herself. Otherwise, it would just make things a lot worse for her. Yeah.
Yeah, and then you start thinking about all of these codependent relationships, and it's like, wow, the only reason she was able to escape that relationship and escape the wave was because of her individuality.
Yeah, like, once you factor in the fact that moms have talked you into so many things for so many years, like, just imagine how many toxic codependent relationships and manipulation, and there's just so many words to describe the factors and variables at play when you're completely ignorant to what's going on.
Yeah.
Like, of course they fell for it. We barely even discovered psychology at this point.
Yeah, which is why it's so important to study these kinds of experiments. Like,
we didn't start doing acid until like 10 years later.
Yeah.
They were screwed.
And we know what kind of a mess happened when they started playing with acid.
Like, this is a culture that wasn't doing peyote and hadn't met God in the desert. Of course it failed.
Which, another question is, like, what did humanity lose? What did the culture of North America lose when we made psychedelics completely illegal? Like, what happened to us during the drug war? What happened to us psychologically that like we couldn't access these acid trips, but not even that. We couldn't even access the question of what might an acid trip be like?
Yeah. What about acacia? What about all of these things that have been around for thousands of years and have changed the way, like, why
in the 50s? I really think we've lost some deep understanding of these ancient texts, like the Vedas, the Old Testament even, because somewhere along the lines we decided, you know, altered states of consciousness, that's the problem. Let's do away with that practice. And let's just worship our gods the way we can see without it. I think we lost a lot in the same way that the Nazis lost their ability to be individuals, or the communists lost their ability to be individuals.
And it's funny because immediately I want to say that McDonald's is probably happy about it, but then right after I have that thought, I think, no, like the hamburger flipper who's done acid and knows that they enjoy the benefits they get from their job, they're much more satisfied and they produce better if they're content with their station in life. But the person who's never had a transcendental experience and doesn't know the place in their world and feels obligated to go to work and feels like they're surviving instead of choosing to be in a state of thriving and being able to be grateful for everything that we're taking for granted in this society, like, I don't see why they wouldn't encourage, you know, introspection and altered states of consciousness, because that's the real key, being happy where you're at.
So here's another question for everybody. Do you think that's what's going to save the world, is a sense of individuality for everybody? Because there's some cases that would say no. And there's some that would say yes.
I think it's a bit of individuality and, you know, self-staked identity and that existential meaning derived from your own experiential perspective lens, and love. And accepting the fact that making statements like humans are shit is really detrimental for a human to think, because you're part of it.
Yeah.
And we're all thinking it and we're all saying it and we're all negative. And it's like, no, you got to scratch it all. Thoughts are seeds and they only grow one type of tree. When you call human shit, you're calling yourself shit. When you say, I just can't today, you're saying that you can't tomorrow. And we don't have that metacognition, that introspection, that looking inwards and saying, what are these thoughts saying to my unconscious brain?
There you go.
So then where
does
community factor in? What's the right amount of community? What's the right amount of discipline? What's the right amount of action and pride?
I think that you'll find that those factors come naturally when you start with love and identity and staring the shadow in the face. If we can bang away at love and value and belief and get rid of blind spots, I think we'll find that a lot of stuff, but boom, we're into an obscure structure.
And again, we're all, you know, obscure creatures. So,
yeah. I feel like I'm looking for a term that doesn't exist yet.
What is it?
I can't make a shape like it.
Is it bigger than a bread box?
That's a good question.
Not four legs.
I don't think so.
Is it an animal? Mineral?
Like, I feel like I'm an ant looking for the word for individual. That's what I really feel like. And it's like there's something in between, you know, the individual and the individual that's completely and fully integrated into their community. And I'm trying to figure out, like, how we create a community that allows for everybody to be an individual. But then you think of like all of the necessity for, you know, cogs in a machine, and you know, that burger flipper, that McDonald's employee. Like, do we just give him acid? And
do you know what the etymology of individual is?
Enlighten me, sir.
It comes from the Latin individus, indivisible.
Huh.
We don't even know what these words mean. We don't even know what we're going after. I think that when you truly become an individual, you probably will become indivisible from humans.
But then everybody has to be an individual. That's necessary for it to work.
I don't know. 2% of the population taking on a concept is enough for the entire planet to become aware of it.
I don't know.
If 2% of the world does a thing, you know someone who's doing the thing.
That's something to start off with.
Make identity cool again.
You see, I always found the word identity being redundant nowadays, but now that you've said that, well, it actually makes it more curious.
Funny. Identity comes from the Latin for quality of being identical. Oh, I don't even know what words mean, guys.
Well, now you have to handle the Wikipedia and the dictionary resources. Look it up, Will.
Now that I know identity and individuality mean indivisibly identical to all humans, that's what we need, folks. I haven't even smoked today.
That is literally my problem right now. I need a bong hit right now. I need an altered state of consciousness to get me through this. My head is swimming right now. I think we need to do like a part two of this conversation, just like a wave cast, literally picking up where we left off, because
yeah, we can do that.
That sounds good.
Oh man.
What else is there to discuss about the book?
I feel like there was something. Oh, there was the football team where, you know, on day one, Ben makes a big deal about, like, with the discipline, strength through discipline. And he says, oh, hey, Brian and David, you guys are on the football team. You know all about discipline. And they're like, yeah, but our football team sucks and we don't know discipline from the, you know, the underside of our boots. So, you know, what do you want to hear from us? And then afterwards, when they've all gotten indoctrinated into this movement, the Brian and David, the football players, they say, well, we got to get everybody on the football team involved in the wave. Then we'll be an actual unit. We'll work together. And then by the end of the book, one of the final actions, like the final nail in the coffin for this experiment, was when the football team lost 42-6. So it didn't work. So the principal said, hey, your experiment didn't work. The football coach said, hey, your experiment didn't work.
Well, and that was the thing, like this amorphous concept of, you know, we're united, but it's like, why aren't you united at 5 a.m. drilling football plays? Like, just wearing the same clothes and saying the same words does not equal right action.
And then they twist it, though. They blame the second string quarterback, the kid that wanted nothing to do with the wave. They said, you know, if this little kid, if he would just smarten up and join the team, we'd be able to beat Clarkstown. But no, it's all his fault. The one guy that wanted to exclude himself from the group, it's all on him, instead of taking responsibility for themselves, which is the exact opposite of the Jordan Peterson message. So if anybody wants to compare Jordan Peterson to this guy, you should do a little bit of homework first. Jordan Peterson knows about cults better than, you know, any other public figure that I've been really paying attention to.
What do you think, Jason?
Well, I think the relationship, kind of going back to individual and community, is I visualize it like the yin and yang. The individual is part and has to be balanced with the community. And if you are unbalanced, if a society is unbalanced, you have too much individualism, or in the case of Nazi Germany, too much community, disorder starts to manifest. But the other thing I found interesting in this book is how it ends, where the teacher realizes he's lost control to the movement, and he realizes he can't just quit, because it's like a hydra. If he were to quit, if he fell, two more would replace him. Two more heads would to come in and replace him. So he had to show the students, he had to get them to want to dissolve this movement. So he shows them a picture of Hitler from Nazi Germany, and they kind of all have an aha moment at the end of the book.
Yeah, it's a little bit bigger than that, though, because right before that, he says, everybody in the wave and only those in the wave were having this huge rally, and we're about to meet our national leader. He says, everybody get ready. Students all over the country have been doing the exact same thing we have. You don't know it, but there is a revolution happening, and all of the kids start losing it. They get excited. They just start saying, oh, it's happening. They start building banners. They all flock to the gym. And he says, you know, for a minute, there's this big screen being projected on. Everyone's confused, like, hey, I thought we were here for our leader. And then eventually the leader appears to them, and it's Adolf Hitler. And then everyone loses it in the worst sense. Half of them start crying.
What a trauma.
Like, imagine being indoctrinated into a cult. Imagine being Robert Billings, saying, this is the first time I've ever had self-worth. And in a week, that's all this experiment lasted, was a week. And then he gets to, like, I'm going to meet my leader. I'm going to meet the man that I'm going to emulate for the rest of my life. And Adolf Hitler. Like, there's no national movement, but if there was, this would be what it looked like. So, you know,
you're all racist. All of you stupid, ignorant students are racist. Here's your leader. Ah, what a terrible human being. Like,
now imagine.
I don't think race.
Now imagine doing this with other dictators of the world. Not just Hitler, but other dictators of the world. Would that have the same effect?
Well, I mean, like, we all respect Vladimir Putin, right?
Yeah, but what would it look like if it was Pol Pot or Joseph Stalin, Mussolini? They would be quite different experiments, really, because they had different kinds of methods of taking over the population. The Nazis,
and performing, you know, showing the same methods that claim to have worked. But then you present, you know, you start a rally, you gather your folks together, and then show them a picture of the national leader that you've been following and worshiping.
Chairman Mao. Oof.
Yeah.
I think the problem is you can't do that, right? You can't conduct experiments on the public unbeknownst to them, to show them, you know, for example, communism doesn't work. So you might end up getting communism out of the equation.
Yeah, and like, you could see how fascism almost came out of a lesson that says, hey, fascism doesn't work. It almost created a functioning fascist state in their school. So what does that really say about what people and ideologies are? Like, is the problem in capitalism or communism, or is the problem just in how we view these modes of existence?
Indeed.
Like obviously Nazism and Stalinism created a lot of death and inefficiency, but when you look at people nowadays protesting capitalism, what exactly is their alternative? What are we gonna go for? Like I'm not sold on the fact that capitalism is perfect. I think we can definitely improve, but I just don't know how we get to that improvement other than every single one of the, you know, 7 billion people on this planet start to act like an individual. And with cultures in existence in the world today that are so adamantly against the idea of individualism, I don't see how that's going to create world peace. I don't see how that's going to create a unity among humanity.
Well, and like that's the problem, right? Is those areas of obscurity where you have people protesting capitalism and purchasing a tent at a store and financing a car and going on a plane. And it's like, you don't get it. You are supporting capitalism through your protest of capitalism. You're on Facebook. You're on a phone.
Yeah, but at the same time, how do you live in a capitalism and also protest against capitalism without using capitalism?
I think John Galt has a good answer to that question.
You're right. Now we're back at
you
square
don't.
One.
You simply don't. But don't pretend that you don't like something while reaping all the benefits of it.
Yeah.
Like, there are tons of abandoned mountains on this planet. You can get there. You can just pack some grain and walk away.
There you go.
It's a little depressing.
I don't recommend that. I think a much better idea would be to run for local office, you know, become a counselor, you know, volunteer, get outside, pick up some litter, do something to help a human being. Remember that you are a node in a network and make the network better by making yourself node better. Live within your means. Stop pretending that this is a capitalist society when in fact it's more of a Daedalist society. And the reason that it persists is because everybody has hung themselves with 10 years of loans.
Hmm.
You know, pay off your student debts. Get a fucking job. Get yourself to a place that you could sustain yourself without the system that you're in. And then you can start talking about other things. But don't tell me that you need to get your student debt forgiven.
Yeah.
It's like, your rights are now my responsibility.
Yeah.
Which I didn't ask for.
Yeah, well, it's like, I didn't ask for it, but now that I know about it, I'm kind of cool with it. Like, healthcare is nice. Roads are sweet. I like lights. Street lights are so helpful. It's nice that I can go a block away and get eggs and not have to deal with the chicken. And they're all the same size.
Yeah, that is really nice. I like my grocery stores and I like my eggs.
Like, sure, you know, existential dread's a thing, and I do kind of feel like we're in a model train set village, but make your bed.
Yeah. I think I have just one more quote that I wanted to bring up from this book, and it was near the end when Ben had realized that the experiment had gone too far and that the ending that we had just described was inevitable, and he's just grading all of the homework and noticing how much neater it is over the past week, and he just says, sloppy homework, I guess that's the price for freedom.
Yeah,
that's a very interesting takeoff.
Yeah,
I kind of wish they hadn't ended the book so abruptly, because the vacuum that all this created would be interesting to read about.
Yeah. Yeah, the after effects.
Yeah, I'd like to hear like a or like read an essay or something written by one of these students today. I think that'd be really cool.
I suppose we could learn about those real life nonfiction vacuums and societies that had these groups.
Yeah, I'm a little bit overwhelmed at this point, to be honest with you. But until next time, may the force be with you.
Or equal to mass times acceleration.
Poof, poof.
Later, guys.